If you're anything like me, you're probably always looking for the next great professional in the land business who can help you do what you need to do, like a great real estate agent or a great closing agent, like a title company or accountants or attorneys or private money lenders. We all know it's not that hard to find any real estate agent or any accountant or any title company. But what if you want the best ones who actually understand the land investing business? There's not that many of them out there. And once you find a good one, there is no doubt they are worth their weight in gold. So how are you supposed to find these people? I used to see these posts in our Facebook group all the time, literally every day, from people who were posting these announcements, hoping to find the best professionals that they needed to work with in order to make their business thrive. And I totally understand why people post these things, because where else are you supposed to go? And so I said, you know, why don't I actually try my best to solve the problem? And so that's what I did. I created several different professional directories on retipster.com that are completely submitted and curated by other members of our community. So say, for example, if you're looking for a great investor-friendly title company in Virginia or someplace like that, and you want to find all the title companies that have worked really well for other investors in the community. Well, guess what? We have that now. Go to retipster.com/directory, and you can find all the different directories that we have going right now. And we're actually creating more of these as I speak. So far, we've got one for land specialized real estate agents, accountants who understand the land business, and investor-friendly title companies. So if you ever need help finding these people in whatever market you're working in, this information is here for you. And we've made it extremely easy to sort these people by state and by their specialty. And we include links to their websites. We give their phone numbers, their contact information, everything. And guess what? It's 100% free. That's right. You don't have to pay anything for this stuff. You don't even have to give us your email address. I'm serious. This is unlike anything else you're going to see out on the internet. This is simply an act of love for the land investing community. So if you would find that helpful, or better yet, if you know of a great title company or land specialized real estate agent or accountant, I'd invite you to come and submit that information too. The more this information we can gather, the better. So again, all you have to do is go to retipster.com/directory. Or if you go to the RE Tipster homepage and you go up to the navigation bar and hover over resources, you'll see a menu item called professional directories. If you click on that, it'll take you to the same place. So just wanted to be sure you knew about that so that you can find the people you need. And if you know of some great people, you can submit their information as well. How much is farmland per acre? Like, what would be a normal average price to pay? Why is land so expensive in places like Iowa and Illinois that are just sort of known as like some of the best places in the world for crops and that kind of thing?
Nobody wants to spend $4 million on a farm to buy somebody else's environmental issue. Commodity prices are just kind of are what they are today versus the last number of years. We've seen prices go up, but we haven't seen the commodity prices just racing out of sight.
If I've got like $50,000 and I want to buy a piece of farmland just to get my feet wet, is that enough money? Like, what is the smallest piece of farmland I could get with financing from a bank? Like, if you were to buy a piece of farmland, what kind of yield would you want to see to say, yes, this is a good deal?
What I would want to see, I guess, is...
Hey, everybody, how's it going? This is Seth Williams. You're listening to the RE Tipster podcast, and today I'm talking with my friend Pat Porter. So this is my second interview with Pat. The first time I talked with him was back in episode 153, where he gave us a ton of great insight into the life of a land broker, how to find a great one, and even what the profession is like and what kind of person is best suited for that line of work. But something you didn't hear in that episode was some of the expertise that Pat has about farmland. And I didn't even realize this the first time we talked, but after I stopped recording, Pat and I continued to talk casually about farmland for about a half hour or so. And I learned so much from the guy about how farmland really works. And that was when it hit me that I needed to get back on the podcast at some point so we could have a whole separate conversation about farmland, because there's a lot you need to know if you ever want to buy this kind of land. And Pat is going to give us kind of a crash course, a lot of that information in this conversation. And just before we hit record here, I was asking Pat, so like, how authoritative of a figure are you in farmland investing? And he was saying, not really, like I'm not the authority on it, But he was saying that maybe like one in five of the deals that he works with are farmland in some way, shape, or form. And that's a whole lot more experience than most people in the RE Tipster audience. So while he may not know everything, I think he still knows a lot. And so we're going to glean as much as we can from him right now. So Pat, welcome back. How you doing?
Hey, Seth. Good, man. Good to see you. Good to be on your show again. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. So we already kind of heard your backstory in episode 153. If anybody wants to go back and hear how Pat got into the business of being a land broker, they're welcome to listen to that earlier conversation. So I'm just going to jump right into the farmland stuff. And was I right in saying that maybe 20-25% of your deals are farmland? Does that sound about right?
Yeah. And again, I just pulled that number out of my ear a minute ago. I don't keep hard metrics on all that, but it's the smallest overall piece of what we do. But, you know, when you do several farms a year and some of them small, some of them big, I guess it does, you know, it does weight in there, you know, maybe, you know, one in five, one in six deals.
Sure. Gotcha. So like you live and work in Louisiana, right? So are most of the deals that you work on in that state, or how often do you work in these kind of deals in other states in that area?
Well, Recland is, my company is in a number of states. I think we're in seven states. But most of the farm deals that we do are here in what we call the Delta, and Louisiana, Arkansas, Mississippi are most of our farmland deals.
So like if somebody's kind of agnostic about which markets they work in, like if I want to go out there and buy farmland, I don't really care where it is. I just want it to be in the U.S. I want it to give me some kind of yield. I mean, do you have an idea, like what are the top 3 to 5 states they should be looking in? I don't know if you know that given where you work, but does anything come to mind? Like, yeah, check out this, this, and this state.
Well, I'm real partial to our part of the universe down here, you know?
Yeah.
Makes sense. I really am. But, you know, just like you, I see a lot of action taking place in the Midwest, you know, where farmland prices are just exorbitant, ridiculous, absurd, through the roof, you pick your adjective, you know? And so those things always jump off the page when I see that. But my expertise of what little bit I do know is down here in our part of the world. And I guess I'm biased to the Delta area down here.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, and when you say the prices are through the roof, so like, what does that mean? Like how much per acre are we talking in your book means like, that's kind of ridiculous. And what's a more normal, reasonable price for farmland?
Well, again, that's my worry. And that's all just a matter of perspective from your vantage point, you know, because we'll sell farms down here, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 an acre. And then I see deals that are going off at $6,500, $7,500, $8,500, $10,500 an acre in the, you know, in Illinois and Iowa and parts of the Midwest, and double what we're doing down here. And I know everything is not exactly apples to apples, but still, you just look at those comparative numbers and you go, wow, when you look at that, you know, a $10,000 an acre deal in the Midwest somewhere versus a $4,500 an acre deal down here. I mean, it's just wow. It really is.
Now, why is land that expensive? Like, is that inflated? Like, are people actually getting a return to justify that? Or is that there's some other weird reason why people are overpaying for farmland? Any ideas on that?
You and I discussed that back in episode one, at the end of episode 153 a little bit.
Yeah.
I actually talked to one of my agents yesterday who he's a second generation farmer, and he sold a number of farm tracts himself, very knowledgeable guy. And he kind of reached back into the 90s when Alan Greenspan used that phrase, exorbitant exuberance, I believe was the phrase he used. He wasn't talking about farmland, but he was talking about just how our irrational exuberance, I believe, is the Greenspan phrase, where he and I are just scratching our heads going, in our little peanut brains, we can't figure out how to make the economics work on some of these numbers. So I don't really know how the economics work on some of those Midwest deals. I've got my opinion, my hunch, but I don't necessarily know for sure how they're making those things work.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Maybe more of a fundamental question is, why buy farmland at all? Like if I'm a newer land investor, I've got a bunch of money laying around, I want to park it somewhere. Like, what is the appeal of farmland? Is it just because it's easy? Like you don't have to do anything? Like it's zero maintenance? Is that why people do it? Or is there some other, I mean, I guess if you were a farmer yourself and you were working the land, that would make probably a lot of sense. But aside from that, like, is there any other reason why you would go out of your way to buy farmland?
Well, as an investor, renting your farmland is relatively easy in this day and time. If I've got a strip center to pull the commercial piece in, for an example, I've always got turnover in tenants. I've always got issues, and not there's anything wrong with commercial investment at all. I know people do it. Everybody does it. A lot of people do it well. It's just what you prefer. In my opinion, farmland is probably a touch easier than something like that. It's a lot more hands off. You've got an operator there, the farmer, who's got a deeply vested interest in making it work. And so they are watching all the little pieces, all the components of it. And so it is a little more, you can be a little more removed from it on the investment side. As of now, it's always in demand. You know, you look at some of the bumper sticker phrases, you know, the world's not getting any bigger, but the population is growing. And so people have to eat, and ag land, farmland is always going to be in demand.
I don't have any like hard statistics on this or anything, but it seems like more and more agricultural land is going out of production every year. At least when I look around my market, I mean, it seems like every year I see a new parcel of farmland that is no longer being farmed. It's being developed into a residential subdivision or something like that. Is that accurate that like we're losing farmland every year? So it's sort of an asset base that's getting lower or smaller and smaller every year.
I would guess. My guess is that we are losing some actual tillable acres. My guess is that because not only does some of it go into a higher and better use for, you know, say development, but also a lot of it, you know, you've got the USDA programs, you know, WRP, WRE, CRP, all the different equip programs that people are putting their farmland into. And so those acres are coming out. However, we also sell a good number of tracts of CRP that are being put back into production. So I don't know the exact data like you. My guess is we're losing some acres, but we might not be, because stuff's going out of production, but there's also stuff going into production as well, or back into production. So that's a great question, Seth. I'd love to see some hard numbers to know the actual acreage. Is it increasing or decreasing?
And when you say CRP, what does that mean?
Conservation Reserve Program. It's a USDA program similar to WRP, where farmland is taken out of production and put into wildlife habitat. And depending on what part of the country it's in, it may go into trees, it may go into grassland, but just put into a conservation program for wildlife habitat. Department of Agriculture pays an annual rental rate to the landowner for the right to be able to keep that land in a conservation program. So it's income to the landowner without having to lease it out to farming.
Is that subsidy that they're getting, is that about what they would be making if they were leasing it out to a farmer? Is it less, do you think, or do you know anything about that?
Yeah, as soon as I say this, there's going to be somebody out there that's going to raise sure. the exception flag and go, no, you're wrong, because I know a place. Okay, there's probably some exception. I know what, you know, in general, in our part of the world, what the CRP rental rate is. Mm-hmm. And when you compare that to, you know, cash rent for farm ground, it's a little less, but it's also guaranteed. It's hands off. You never have to do anything, never have to touch it. It's a check that comes annually, once a year. You don't do anything to the property. So yeah, if it's a little less, there's some trade off in that you're not having to be hands on anymore with your property. You literally can put it in a program, walk away and forget about it.
Do you know why that's a thing? Like, why is the government paying people to not do anything? Like, I'm sure there's some rationale behind that. Do you know what that is?
I don't want to mislead anybody. In those USDA programs that are WRP, CRP, those type of conservation programs are not the government just giving you money to leave your land alone. There is a purpose there. It's taking a substandard, according to somebody's definition, substandard farm ground, taking it out of production and putting it back into either wetland habitat, wildlife habitat, trees and grasses. So there's some value to that. It's not a straight, we'll give you money just not to farm your land. You do have those types of programs that farmers will understand better than I do, where you lay out land and you're paid a little bit not to farm it. But those CRP, WRP, those type programs, in my opinion, are not exactly that.
So you might have already said this, but I know the answer to this question is going to vary a lot by state. But when you look at your neck of the woods in Louisiana and the surrounding states, so like how much is farmland per acre? Like what would be a normal average price to pay?
Just ballpark gun to my head. This part of the country down here, the last dry farm I sold down here not long ago was $3,900 an acre, which is a little bit strong for dry farm ground, at least compared to what it has been. And then irrigated ground, $4,800 to $5,500 an acre. That's down here. Now, there are some exceptions. There are a few unicorns out there that we've seen sell for like $65, which is, down here in our part of the world, it seems unheard of. In fact, when I heard it, I'm going, wow, I can't believe it sold for that. But again, that's not anywhere near some of the numbers we see in the Midwest. But the dry ground, ballpark, high threes, low fours, good irrigated farms, now high fours, fives, and even sneaking into the low sixes an acre.
And correct me if I'm wrong about any of this stuff, but my understanding in terms of like, why is land so expensive in places like Iowa and Illinois that are just sort of known as like being some of the best places in the world for crops and that kind of thing? And I think it has a lot to do with like annual rainfall. Like if you just don't have an irrigated farm and you just rely on nature to water your crops, is it going to happen? Or are they going to dry out and you're going to lose everything? So it's that kind of thing. There's also like the soil type. There's also like the type of crops that can be grown because certain crops are maybe worth more than others. And there's a lot of stuff beyond that. I actually have a blog post where I looked pretty deep into this and looked at over 7 different nationwide maps that kind of point out these areas are good because of this reason. And it's obviously not just one thing you'd look at, but a lot of different factors. But am I on the right track? Is there other stuff that influences the value of land beyond that?
Well, those are excellent points because generally in the Midwest, you've got across the board a little bit different soil type to grow grains, the rainfall that you mentioned. So there's a little bit less irrigation cost. But still, the cost of diesel is the same across the country. The cost of nitrogen is the same. Inputs is a phrase you'll hear farmers use a lot. What it costs to put a crop in the ground, the input cost. Those input costs are still as strong up there for the most part as they are down here in the Delta. But the prices are double in the Midwest than they are down here. But the part where I scratch my head is good as the soils are, say, just use Iowa for an example, Iowa, Illinois, those places. They're not growing 600 bushels an acre of corn. We grow some strong corn down here. We may be in the low mid 200s an acre bushel, a bushel an acre. And then you go, okay, everything being equal, that means I should be growing about 400 bushels an acre in Iowa. They're not. The yield is not, doesn't keep up with the ratio in yield increase doesn't keep up with the ratio in the land increase. And that's the part where we kind of scratch our head a little bit and go, how are they making this work? The commodity prices are the same there as they are here. And the yields are not that much greater. They are greater on an average, but not double and triple. So these other factors that you mentioned, they do cut into it a little bit in terms of being able to make the return stronger. But I'm mumbling a little bit because, again, I keep bumping my head against the wall going, how do they make $8,500 an acre of land work? How do they pencil that out with the cost of growing that crop?
I'm also speaking a little bit out of ignorance here. I don't know, but I do have a cousin-in-law, husband of my cousin, who is a pig farmer in Iowa, kind of over by South Dakota, and he owns a lot of land. He was telling me something about how, and this is like 10 plus years ago, but he was telling me that apparently a lot of farmland owners from California will buy up land in Iowa and drive the prices way up, like way higher than they should be. And I don't know what the play on that is. I don't know if they just have a ton of extra cash and they're just trying to park it somewhere. I'm not really sure, but I think you're right in terms of like whatever financial yield you get from that. Like, I don't know that it does make sense, but like if you have millions just sitting around and you don't know what else to do with it and you happen to be in the farming business, why not buy farmland? Maybe there's something going on there is my only guess.
Let me tell you, and maybe some of your listeners will be able to make some, comment when this is released down the road and give us some insight, because you got a smart audience and they're a lot smarter than I am. So let me give you my theory on why that works up there. And I'm probably so far off base that everybody's going to laugh, but it's the only thing I can make sense in my mind. You've got these generational farmers that own their land. They own it outright. And they've been multi-generational farmers, handed down, and they've got, say, 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 acres, whatever. A farm comes up for sale that's either joins them or nearby in their footprint, so to speak, that they can then roll that into their operation without it being burdensome. And they can then pay, just for conversation's sake, let's say $8,000 an acre. Crazy number, in my opinion, but they can pay $8,000, $9,000 an acre for a 80, 90, 200 acre tract that comes up for sale. Well, they paid that crazy amount. They roll it into their existing footprint that really doesn't have any debt, so to speak, in terms of their land cost. And so they've taken that $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 an acre for a couple of hundred acres, spread it out into their whole operation, and they've diluted the cost of that land down greatly just by rolling it into their existing operation, and it becomes very manageable at that point. That's the only thing that I can see how that works. But then you throw a wrench into it when you talk about these outside investors who don't have that existing footprint leverage, so to speak, that they can just roll something into and dilute the cost out. They're coming in for it. Now they've got a big debt nut to service in addition to all the just the normal costs and expenses of owning ground or farming ground. How they make that work, Seth, I don't know. But my little humble little theory of how owner operators just roll it into their existing farm footprint, I can see how that works because that makes economic sense to me. I can do the math on that. I'm not a smart guy, but I can do that little bit of math. I can go, yeah, I can make that work.
Absolutely. No, it totally makes sense. Say if you're already farming a bunch of ground and there's like a parcel right across the street, like it could make a lot more sense for you to do that than for some other person who has to travel 20 miles to get there to do it. I don't know. Maybe there's some economies of scale there too.
The economies of scale is a very good phrase for it to kind of boil it down. But that's the only thing I can understand. I hope some of your listeners will you know, who have some insight will jump in here in a month or so or whenever this is released, a couple months and go, no, hey, guys, here's what's going on. And we'll both learn something.
Yeah, no, I know. I love it when that stuff happens. Yeah. Actually, I should probably have a conversation with my friends at Acre Trader because they probably deal with a lot more of this macroeconomic stuff in terms of, you know, farmland markets as a whole and all this stuff. But I totally appreciate your insight where you're coming from as just kind of like the hands-on down to earth, like you're dealing directly with people buying individual farms like this. But I'm wondering, if you don't know the answers to any of this stuff, no worries. I'm just trying to pull out anything you might be confident about.
It's not just us. It's not like we're the only two, forgive me, only two dummies out here that don't understand how the economics of it work. Here's other people. I've got a pretty good client that we have sold some farms to over the last decade and a half. He lives up in your part of the world. He doesn't buy farms up there. He buys them down here because he can make the numbers work better. This conversation I've had with him multiple times, he owns farms in three states down here, and some of them substantial farms, large farms. He doesn't buy them up there. He buys them down here. He's a long way away. He gets good operators, and he does very well, but he's also scratching his head, and he lives up there. He prefers our economics a lot better than the economics in the Midwest.
Well, that's a great point. I mean, there's really no reason why you couldn't do that as a farmland investor, buy land in some other state that you never really see. You just need to know that the fundamentals make sense and that it's a good piece of farm ground and you can find a good farmer to lease it from you and that kind of thing. That leads me to another question I've got. So just like any land investment, there are different hot button issues that can kind of make a big difference in terms of whether or not a farmland investment is good or bad based on the geography and what different factors might affect it. For example, like wetlands and flood zones and soil types and all this stuff. So, and this varies a lot depending on what state you're working in. For example, if I'm trying to buy a piece of farmland in Louisiana and I've never been to that area, how important is it that I personally go and physically inspect that property myself? Or what kind of tests or due diligence should I make sure I'm doing to make sure this is a good piece of land and I'm not buying something that's going to be really difficult to make money from in the future?
That's a heck of a good question. That comes into play a lot in what we do. I'm thinking of a little small farm I sold for a gentleman several years ago. But the guy in California, he's an IT guy. He's doing this his whole life. He never leaves the screen. He bought it as an investment. And he asked me just for a checklist of things. Hey, Pat, what do I need to make sure? What boxes do I need to check due diligence wise to check this farm out? Because I'm not going to fly out there and look at it. I don't know what I'm looking at if I do, but what do I need to do? And I gave him several things to look at. And as the farm size increases, this list will get a little bigger and we'll get a little more involved. But, you know, I said, hey, man, just, you know, let's look at the soils. And of course, the soil types are easy to determine. NRCS, we can do it right now on the internet right now, you know, with soil types to make sure that the wells are operational, to make sure that all the irrigation pieces, the risers and all of that, any reservoir capture areas are make sure all the irrigation's in good shape, to make sure there's a decent the infrastructure's in place for the market. The crops have to go somewhere and have to go there in an efficient manner. Is the infrastructure in place? Is there a good base for tenants? You know, sure, you've always got somebody clamoring to lease it from you today, but is he a good long-term guy? Or if he goes away, something happens, and do I have people in line that I can easily rent my farm to going forward? The soils, the wells, the infrastructure are huge deals. Knowing that they can rent it out and what those kind of area rental rates are, knowing those things are very important. If it's a larger farm, you're going to find people that are going to have environmental studies done to make sure that there's no chemical seepage, massive fuel spills, anything eroding into creeks and streams and rivers, you know, to cause them any environmental issues. Phase one environmental studies getting pretty common these days to make sure at least that's done. Nobody wants to spend $4 million on a farm to buy somebody else's environmental issue. That's become kind of the top of the list for a lot of buyers to make sure that there are no environmental issues, problems in place. Irrigation systems, if it's an above ground irrigate, you know, pivot systems, those things are becoming less and less desirable in our world. People want to get away from the pivots and, you know, use underground systems or poly pipe, you know, above ground, movable irrigation structure. Those are just a handful of big items right there.
When you mentioned soil types, I don't know if you know this granular level of information, but like, what kind of soil type do you want to see and what do you not want to see? Like, what's a problem when you go to the USDA soil maps and see what's there on the property?
You know, there are a lot of people know a lot more about soils than I do. I use the data and I use it routinely, you know, when I'm looking at farm ground. And also, you know, we sell a big part of our business is timberland. I use the same NRCS website to look at site index for here in our part of the world, loblolly pine. Same data, it's just a different crop, you know, pine tree versus soybeans, corn, or milo, that kind of deal. Soils are called different things in different places. A class one soils in your world are going to have a different name than class one, class two soils in my world. You start learning those names of those different soil types and what to look for. So I couldn't throw out any names because they're going to be different with every one of your listeners in different places. But typically, you want to learn the good silty loams versus the heavy clays. You want to know the difference in those because that matters based on the type of crop that is the predominant crop in that area or the mainstay that somebody that's going to be farming your place is going to be growing. You know, here in our part of the world, you know, we've got here in Northeast Louisiana, specifically up and down along the river, we've got some real heavy clays, and those heavy clays are tough sometimes when it comes to irrigation.
It's because it doesn't drain well. Is that the problem?
Exactly. Yeah. Then we got, the silty loamy type soils are what most guys are looking for because they do drain well. So learning the names of the soils for the silty loams and the heavy clays in your area is what's important in my mind.
Well, that's as you were talking there, Pat, I just asked ChatGPT, the ultimate authority of all truth, what kind of soil types farmers would or wouldn't want to see. And it basically just matched what you said. Said good soils for farming would be loam, sandy loam, silt loam, and the worst soil types would be like heavy clay, sandy soil, and rocky soil. So I don't know, whatever that's worth.
The rocky soil, yeah. See, that's something that here in our part of the world, it never comes to mind. But, you know, we sell a lot of land. We're licensed in Missouri. And, you know, in my mind, Missouri is all rock, you know. But, yeah, so that's a good point. Yeah, the rocky ground.
Do you ever see people who buy raw land? Maybe it's like a forest or something, and they develop it into farmland? Like, does that ever happen? So like, what does that cost per acre to do that? Any idea?
It's not going to be a one size fits all, but it's be, give you an example. I have a very good friend, lifetime friend, in Arkansas. I'm in Louisiana. He's in Arkansas, South Arkansas. He's an hour and a half, 2 hours away. He buys these types of tracts and will go in and clear them. So he'll have all the timber cut, and then he'll have it completely stumped. All the stumps removed, piled, burned. Then he'll go in and have it landformed and irrigated. Now, he can do a lot of his own work because he's got heavy equipment. He's got guys that can run it. So he's got some economies in place that your average bear doesn't have. But ballpark an acre, he's looking at, you know, $1,000 an acre to get water on it. He's looking at $200 to $500 an acre to stump it, rake it, and burn it. And that's at his numbers. It's going to be a good bit higher at ours. So, but ballpark, using his example, he's $2,000 an acre is what it's going to take him, plus the time. And so you got the cost of money. But without getting into that part of the equation, couple thousand dollars an acre. So, but he's looking at, okay, if I do this improvement, I've got ground that's now worth 45 to 5,000 an acre. So if he can get in it for a couple of thousand an acre, let's say for round numbers, do that work, couple of thousand, he's got 4,000, say for conversation, 4,000 an acre in it. He's got something that he can then farm himself because they farm several thousand acres. He can farm it, a good irrigated piece of ground that he created himself for a little bit less than he could have bought it for. But the problem is you can't just go out. It's not on the shelf. You can't just go out and buy it, you know, in your footprint. So he had to go kind of make it. So he's created a valuable piece of ground for him for, say, $500 to $1,000 an acre cheaper than he could have bought it for if he could have found it. And it's where he wanted it because he chose the track. It's in his footprint. He did the work. He made it work himself. And so he's kind of like a custom land developer for his own farm. $2,000 an acre is his number. And that's him being able to shave costs, shave some money because he can do a lot of the work himself.
That's a great example. I had this conversation with a farmland broker about 5 years ago, and he told me very similar numbers to that. But to your point, the question I asked you was like impossible to answer because there's so many different. Like, what if there's no trees on it? What if it's already perfectly flat? What if, you know, there's ravines and all this stuff? It just depends totally on that property. And also, it sounds like this guy had a really nice competitive advantage in that he could do a lot of work himself. I mean, that's, I would never be able to do that. So if I had to pay somebody else to do the exact same thing, I'd probably be paying, I don't know if it's $3,000 an acre or what it would be, but it's a really interesting thing to think about because I know a lot of land flippers in our audience are always looking for new ways that they can add value to properties, whether it's subdividing them or putting some kind of improvement on it. And this is something I don't think a lot of us have really thought about in terms of what if I could buy a piece of land? And what if it cost me, say, $1,000 to convert this to farmland that I could then sell for $4,000 an acre? I mean, it would definitely be a very much more involved project. And it would be, you know, a lot of costs up front to do that. But I haven't heard anybody who's done that. And I'm sure there's opportunity like that out there.
It's a very niche thing to do because the capital outlay to do that is huge. You know, we're talking about even at my buddy's number, a couple $1,000 an acre, that's real money. And over time, and he's a good while before he starts getting any returns. So he's got his neck out there until he gets this thing, a crop on it and starts getting a little bit of return. You know, but they're third generational farmers. They know what they're doing. It's not their first rodeo. You know, so it's a lot less risk when you know what you're doing and you've done it in the past and you've kind of been there, done that. Take some of the sting out of the risk. They also, in our part of the country, this doesn't work everywhere, but, you know, you use the example of it's got trees on it. They also buy catfish pond, ground that's been in catfish ponds, and just convert the ponds back into, you know, tillable acres. That's same scenario, but just a, you know, bird of a different color, so to speak. Instead of taking down trees, you're taking down levees. and, you know, forming the ground for irrigation based on that. So that's popular down here too, but it's hard to find those tracks. But when you can find them, they really make some pretty good farms.
Do you know, like, what is a normal financial yield? Not crop yield, but like, what kind of ROI should a person reasonably expect if they invest in a piece of farmland? Like, is it 3% or 5%? Or, and I know this, again, this depends totally on the person and all this stuff, but like, if you were to buy a piece of farmland, what kind of yield would you want to see to say, yes, this is a good deal?
What I would want to see, I guess, is, of course, I'd want to see double digits. You know, okay, great, fine, knock yourself out. You go buy all those up you can. But in the real world, to use my Midwest guy who buys farms down here in the Delta, and he's a heavy hitter. Now, he doesn't buy tens and twenties. He buys, you know, several hundred, several thousand acre, big farms, multiple farms. He has to have, if it's not 3.5, he won't even entertain it. So he's 3.5 and up. 3.5 to 5.5 is his sweet spot. If he can find something over 5.5, sign him up as quick as he can, because he understands that it's just difficult to buy an established farm that's ready to go day one, that he can get an operator on immediately. 4% and 5%, he's in there all day long. Sign him up. I'm sure that you've got some listeners that they've got some spots and places, you know, they may be in the 6-7%. That's great. That's a strong return for farm ground, because that's a ROI on the ground. But then you've also got the asset that's appreciating right now, at least, pretty rapidly. So you're doing well on two sides of the equation. The asset's appreciating and you're getting, you know, ROI for your cash. So to answer your question, 4-5% is kind of where most folks want to be, from my experience in our part of the world.
That's really good to know, because just so people kind of understand what they're signing up for, what they're chasing after, if they try to buy a piece of farmland, like, that's kind of the average or the normal range of what some people go after. And when I hear that, like, it doesn't get me terribly excited. That's not a huge yield, but to your point, the appreciation is there. It's a very easy investment. It doesn't require a whole lot of effort for the landowner to do anything, provided they have a good tenant who will lease it up again and again. So is the fact that there is some return on it, maybe not huge, but there's something, but also just the ease of it. And then also the appreciation, are those kind of the reasons why people do this instead of investing in, say, a hotel or a self-storage facility? Like, why go after farmland when there's stuff that makes more money out there?
Tomato, everybody's got, looks at it differently. They may call the same thing. I don't know. Everybody's just different. Also to the stage of your life. You know, if you got a guy that's, you know, like my buddy, I keep talking about in the Midwest, you know, he's in his late 60s. Heck, he may be in his early 70s now. He doesn't want a high risk situation. He wants steady, dependable, rock solid, a reasonably easy asset to handle estate-wise, you know, because, I mean, he's in the fourth quarter, you know. You probably have some buddies, maybe some, you know, I've got some investment friends that, you know, heck, it's early in the first quarter for them, or early second quarter in life. You know, they're wide open. They got a lot of time to correct some mistakes if they mess up. So it probably just has to do with season of life, ease of investment. You know, if you're dealing with a real turnkey developed farm down here in the Delta, or probably just about anywhere, you're dealing with the tenant a couple times a year. You may talk to them a few times just to check on things. You get a check from them once or twice a year. You get a certificate of insurance, additional insured from them once a year. You know, the management of something like that is just a few minutes of your time versus a multi-resident unit, a hotel, a commercial building. That's every day, all day, nonstop, late at night, 2 a.m., you know, toilet overflowing. You've got so many different things going on, and you got folks that just don't want that hassle. They've got cash. They park it in a good asset. They get the return they're anticipating. The money's in the bank. The details are taken care of. No muss, no fuss. It's just easy. And the risk is tiny, tiny.
Now, you mentioned that farmland is appreciating right now. So Why is that? Like, what all affects farmland values? Is it like commodity prices? I've heard in my conversations with different farmland experts that like it's not really tied to the housing market at all. Like housing values can be plummeting while farmland values are going way up. So like, what is causing that?
Demand. You have, you know, something that's happened. And again, I'm 59 years old. I haven't seen everything. I don't know everything. My understanding is based on my history and time. We've had so much foreign investment that's come into farmland and funds. There are a lot of, I've sold farms to large funds that go out and they make these big purchases and they drive the demand. You know, the supply gets a little tighter because you've got, you know, foreign investors or you've got big funds that are buying up massive chunks. And so your demand is there, but the supply is almost finite. It's limited. And so that's going to drive the prices up. Commodity prices drive the prices up, but that's a two-edged sword because, like again, my buddy and I were talking yesterday, one of my agents is a farmer. Commodity prices are just kind of are what they are today versus the last number of years. We've seen prices go up, but we haven't seen the commodity prices just racing out of sight. So that's a head scratcher, but that does drive it, commodity prices. I guess, the outside demand and the commodity prices and the limited supply. And I say limited supply because you and I both talked about just a few minutes ago, we wonder, are ag or tillable acres increasing or decreasing? I personally think they may be decreasing a little bit. So that supply is pretty flat or maybe even decreasing, in my opinion. Could be going up, but it's not a massive supply of farm ground. So that's all got to factor into it.
If I've got like $50,000 and I want to buy a piece of farmland just to get my feet wet, is that enough money? Like what is the smallest piece of farmland I could get with financing from a bank and it would still make sense? Like that small of a parcel even exists out there. Like are there 10 acre parcels of farmland or is like 40 the minimum or how much cash would I need and how small would a parcel need to be before I could really feasibly get that thing?
I would get a lot of pushback from your folks, because everybody's got a different strategy and different perspective, and I respect that. So, but from my point of view, an investor buying farm ground in this day and time doesn't want to use a lender. Just think about it right now. If you went and bought a piece of ground, you bought a farm, what the interest would be just with the banks you use, what's the interest rates, you know, and you look at your return and you're going, golly, my return might not service the note. It might not, depending on your mathematics there and depending on how much cash you put into it. So I would think it would need to be a cash investor who's buying an asset that they're going to just lease out and not own or operate. And so with that in mind, it's got to be a straight up cash deal. To find a good tenant in our part of the world, yeah, 40 acre farms, people lease them all the time, but it's got to be in a good spot. It's got to be in a footprint that there are a lot of good operators so that you can always keep that 40 acres rented, because 40 is small, especially if you're wanting to irrigate it. You know, 40 acres is a pretty small tract of ground to irrigate. There's a lot of them out there. Don't get me wrong. They're out there. But sometimes economics get out of whack on a small piece because the cost is the cost and you don't have as many acres to spread it across. I go put down a well. It's a flat fee. I mean, it's a number, one well to service 40 acres. I can't put down a half a well or a quarter of a well. I got to put down the well. And I could put down that same well and maybe serve as 120 acres, 200 acres, just depending. So I can spread that cost out over more acres. And that makes sense to you and all your listeners. But if it's a small piece, it's got to be in a great footprint, because it's hard for a good operator who's 45 minutes away to put equipment on the road and employees on the road to go and work a 40-acre tract somewhere, because you lost a tenant and you got to lease it to this other guy. So you got to have people all around those smaller tracks to keep it leased out. Did that make sense?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. If it's a large farm, that, you know, it's a lot easier, but a small farm is tougher.
And that was one of those kind of light bulb moments I had. It's actually like a very obvious thing you're saying here, but it just never occurred to me until we talked about this last time when you mentioned location matters in terms of like, there's got to be sort of an existing farmer economy in that area. Don't just like develop a 40-acre piece of farmland, you know, 100 miles from the nearest farm. Like it's it's going to be a lot harder for you that way.
I tell you how I learned that, Seth. I don't mean to interrupt you, but just to, I tell you how I learned that. It's not like I came into this with all this knowledge and information. I was helping the Louisiana guy who is a farmer and an investor and a real estate agent. He's a land agent, helping him look at a farm probably 5 hours away from us in north central Arkansas. And it was a great price. And it was a beautiful farm. I mean, it was all there. And then it was just, you pluck it out. You look at that farm, you go, oh, wow, this is great. What a deal. But the more we dug into it, and again, I'm listening to him a lot because he is the farmer. He is the guy. He's going, you know, I can't farm this. This is 6 hours from my operation. I've got to find tenants up here. And then we started looking at the market around it, the infrastructure around it. Just to haul the grain to elevators was a long, long way. There were very few large farmers in the area that he could lease to. We ended up passing on the deal, and it was, the numbers were really good, and he passed on it, and he's an aggressive buyer, but he passed on it because there was a limited number of tenants available, and the infrastructure in that general, that greater area around that farm was so insignificant that he's saying, man, I'd have to buy it for $1,000 an acre less than what they're asking, feasibly make it work. And that's when I realized, wow, just because, you know, it's a beautiful farm, it seems like it has everything. These are two big factors that made the difference for this guy. And he is a pro. I've sold him lots of ground. And so that started getting my attention when I saw him react that way. And I'm going, those are important factors. You take that same farm, you pluck it out, and you come put it anywhere in my part of the world down here, 5,000, 6,000 an acre. But up there, he passed on it for a lot less money just because he couldn't make it work.
So this idea of buying a piece of farmland that's not irrigated and then irrigating it, and that just by doing that, it makes the property's value go up significantly just because now it's irrigated and the farmer can kind of have more of a guarantee that their crop is actually going to turn out well. So it almost kind of reminds me of like flipping a house where you buy something that's worth less, you make an improvement, and it's very clearly worth more as a result of that. Made me wonder, like, how does that work in terms of like, what does it cost to buy, use this 40 acre example that's not irrigated, and then like drill the well, add the irrigation equipment. I don't know if you have any examples in Louisiana there, just in terms of the cost of that. Like, I know to drill a well in Texas would probably be a lot more than it would be in Louisiana, for example, but just thinking through that kind of project on paper, like if I wanted to buy a parcel of farmland, add the irrigation, sell it for more, does that ever make sense? Like, do the numbers work out?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. One little point to add in, since we're talking about irrigation specifically, again, you'll have folks that'll go, hey, I know a different exception. Many, I don't want to use the word most because I don't know, but I do know many lenders whose business is crop loans for farmers, for operators. They're requiring the ground to be irrigated to loan on it because they know that it greatly protects their investment. You get a better chance of a better yield on irrigated ground. And so a lot of lenders are going, hey, if it's not irrigated, we're not going to be able to help you on your crop loan like we used to, or like, you know, we've done in the past. So that irrigation is getting more and more important, other than just making sure my corn's getting the proper inches or, you know, moisture every year. But to answer your question, yeah, just ballpark, we put a well down, you know, there's 10,000 right there. And then you've got the infrastructure. If you've got underground piping, again, all that's going to depend on the distance and the degree of work. Most farmers down in our part of the world now are using risers with polypipe because polypipe has gotten so easy to use. It's pretty inexpensive. And you understand, polypipe, you know what I mean. And I'm sure your readers do, or your listeners do too.
Wait, why don't you tell us what that is, just in case we don't know what that is?
Polypipe, if it's a 12 inch diameter white plastic tubes you've seen laying PVC on the ground. Yeah, that's polypipe, and it's hooked up to risers. Risers are a solid piece that come out of the ground that the well pushes water through pipes to the riser. It's called a riser because it rises out of the ground. Hook the polypipe to it, and water fills the pipe, and they lay that pipe down out along the row so it runs down the row furrows. And then they'll pierce the pipe. It doesn't come with holes in it. It's a solid piece, but you just go in and you puncture it in each furrow and to let the water out, and it runs down the rows, polypipe. It's a real easy, efficient way to water these days. Anyway, you got the well 10,000, you got your infrastructure of the underground piping, the risers. That's one thing. But the major cost outside the well is you've got to make sure your ground is to grade so that the water will run the rate you want it to run, the direction you want it to run. Because if the ground's not properly leveled and set to grade, will flow a certain direction at a certain pace, then it really becomes useless. And a lot of people don't think about it. I'll put a well down. Well, yeah, but that ground is all like this and crazy. You know, it's got to be leveled. And we use the word level, but the ground's not level. It's set to grade. It's actually at an angle, very small angle, but set to a grade. And the cost of that runs the gamut, depending on how much work it takes to cut that ground to grade. There's some ground it's easy to cut because it's just, you know, gently rolling. They don't have to cut much. And it's already sort of rolling the direction that makes sense for the shape of the tract. So cutting it to grade can be very expensive. It can be several hundred dollars an acre, no matter what. But it can really get more substantial depending on how much it takes to put that property to grade. So each one of them is going to be different, but you're looking at, again, I use my Arkansas buddy as an example. He roughly says, hey, if I buy a piece of ground to get water on, it's going to cost me anywhere from $1,000 to $1,500 an acre. Just sort of his rule of thumb in his universe.
Is there like an industry professional, like if I'm trying to do a Google search for whoever can help me figure out what those costs are going to be, is there like a certain type of contractor that does all of that? Or do I have to contact one person for the irrigation equipment and then find an excavator who can move the earth around? Like, how do I figure out and put those numbers together to figure out the real cost for that?
Typically, you got two different folks there. You got your irrigation people and then you've got your dirt guys. And there are companies out there that landform and will cut a piece of property to grade. And it's just, I don't know how to tell you who to use anywhere. I mean, I know who I'd use down here because I'm local. But, it's just going to be finding those people online. It's going to be very easy. Somebody's in a farming community, there's going to be a handful of irrigation companies. They're probably going to know irrigation companies just by name, even if they've never used them. They've heard of this company, that company, because they're the ones that put down wells, and not just for farm ground. They put down wells for WRP, for duck impoundments, for catfish ponds. They put down wells for rural home sites. They're the company that does it. So they're the easy guys to find. And then you got to shop around just a little bit for the landformers.
Awesome. Pat, thanks so much. I'm very grateful to have the chance to talk to you about this stuff. If people want to learn more about you or check out farmland properties you've got for sale, what's the best place to go for that?
Recland.net is our main website. And of course, I'm easy to find on social media. Don't look for Pat Porter. You won't find much of that. But you'll find, if you search Recland, Recland Realty, or Recland Talks on any of the social platforms, you'll find us. But Recland.net is our main site.
I'll be sure to include links to all that stuff in the show notes for retipster.com/182.
Back in program 153 that we did, you put a link in there that if any of your listeners wanted to email me for a copy of one of my books, and I had a ton of responses. People emailed, awesome. Asked questions. I sent them. Be glad to do that again for your listeners. You got a great audience out there. So it doesn't cost anything. There's no tricks, gimmicks. You don't get put on a mailing list. You just simply email me at office@recland.net. Ask for one of our land books. And be sure to put your address in there. I'm not a mind reader. Seth, if you want to put that in your show notes, I'd be absolutely glad to honor that again. I'm happy to take care of your people.
You bet. office@recland.net. I'll include that in the show notes as well. Again, retipster.com/182. And again, thanks a lot, Pat. It's great to know you. Great to talk to you about this stuff. And hopefully we can talk again soon.
Seth, my pleasure, buddy. Take care, man. Thank you.
Hey, Hey folks, I hope you love what you just heard. Before you go, I want to make sure you're aware of the RE Tipster newsletter. This is something that we spend a lot of time pulling in content and conversations from throughout the RE Tipster community. We want to make sure you're aware of the hottest stuff that's going on right now. Things like active deals from other wholesalers in the community in the RE Tipster deal marketplace, or changes in the industry that affect you and you need to know about. And of course, I'm always sharing the latest software and tools and services that I'm using that I think you should know about. And if you followed RE Tipster for any length of time, you already know there's a whole lot more I could talk about because there's a lot that happens in our community each week. And this is stuff you really don't want to miss. And that's why it's so important for you to be aware of what's going on. All you got to do is take out your phone, maybe even the phone you're listening to right now. Go ahead and text the word free, that's F-R-E-E, to the number 33777. And we'll get you added to the email list so you get this newsletter and you're always aware of the most important things going on in our industry. Thanks again for listening. Again, just text the word free to 33777 and we'll get you squared away. Talk to you next time.